Hello, everyone, and welcome to this special edition of Employment Matters, brought to you by the Employment Law Alliance, the world's largest network of labor and employment lawyers from the best law firms around the globe. I'm your host, Pete Waltz. Well, today's a special day at the ELA. It's Tuesday, and on Tuesday, that means the Employment Matters podcast does Travel Tuesday. Each week, we get the chance to dial in our members from all around the world, and they share with us some of the important things that we need to know about doing business in their jurisdiction. Today, we're going to be learning more about doing business in England and Wales. I'm pleased to welcome to the show Tim Gilbert, a partner and head of employment at Travers Smith, and Ailey Murray, also a partner in the employment department at Travers Smith. Tim and Ailey, so glad to have you with us today. Let's get started. Tim, I'd like to start with you. We usually start the Travel Tuesday broadcast with an overview of the economical and political backdrop in that jurisdiction. So what can we say? And I'm sure there's a lot to say about the economic and political backdrop in the UK at the moment. What do you think?
So the economic climate in the UK was challenging in 2023. There was low growth and the UK actually entered a shallow technical recession at the back end of last year. 2024 forecasts suggest the outlook will improve as the year progresses, but it's going to do so slowly. So difficult economic times. In terms of the labour market in the UK, well, there's been a labour shortage for quite a while, and that's for various reasons. This includes people leaving the UK following Brexit, and also people leaving the labour market after the COVID pandemic, and whether that was for health reasons or retirement. And of course, following Brexit, employers in the UK aren't able to draw on EU labour as easily as they could before. Now, the market's been improving, but many employers are still having difficulties recruiting in certain roles and sectors, especially hospitality, construction, manufacturing. They're all really struggling in the labour market. And yet, on the flip side, some employers are starting to have to reorganize, restructure, and making redundancies in response to a downturn in work reflected by the economic situation. So overall, it's a pretty mixed picture. And on the political backdrop, well, the UK will be having a general election soon, expected to be in the autumn of this year. And this is going to result in a few changes to our employment laws, which we can pick up a bit later on.
Well, it sounds like an awful lot going on over there. And obviously, the employment issues are impacted for your clients at the moment. Ailey, if you can, just give us an overview of what those main issues are.
Sure. Thanks, Pete. The biggest area of work for us for some time now has been investigations work, and it's showing no signs of slowing. So employers are keen to ensure that they have an open workplace culture in which employees can safely speak up. And there is a lot of emphasis on this in both the financial services sector, where the UK regulator highlights it as a key concern, but also more widely from investors from an ESG perspective. And part of having an open culture is ensuring that any complaints are investigated properly. And we frequently advise clients on investigations, or we might be asked to carry out the investigation ourselves. Alternatively, we sometimes instruct third parties, such as HR consultants, to carry out the investigation, and then we advise on the outcome and the next steps in the background. So we've also been working with clients on updating their whistleblowing policies and carrying out training as part of encouraging that kind of open speak-up culture.
Well, that's a great overview of what's going on, and certainly a lot of that echoes, I hear that from some of our other jurisdictions as well. But let's get down to the need-to-know stuff. That's the one thing our listeners always enjoy about Employment Matters. We really get to the core of the issue. So moving on to what we need to know about doing business in the UK. Tim, can you tell us first what the key rights of employees and workers are and how they work with those?
Sure. So I should probably start by explaining the different categories of workers that we have in the UK. So unlike many countries, which may just have two categories, employed or self-employed, we have three in the UK. So these are employees, workers, and self-employed. Now, an employee is someone who has a contract of employment, and they have the full range of employment rights that we provide here. That includes the right to claim unfair dismissal, the rights to minimum wage, holiday, pension, protection from discrimination, all of that kind of stuff. By way of contrast, self-employed individuals, so these are contractors or consultants, well, they only benefit from protection from discrimination, a much narrower band of protection. Workers sit between employees and self-employed. So workers are a sort of hybrid category, a person who doesn't have a contract of employment, but also at the same time isn't self-employed. So when they carry out an assignment, they're not supplying their services to clients of their own business. So someone on a 0 hours contract or a casual worker contract will often be a worker rather than an employee. And workers still benefit from certain statutory protections, including minimum wage, holiday, and pension, but there are employment rights they can't claim, like, for example, unfair dismissal.
So that's an interesting group of employee types there. Let's talk about when we recruit folks. Haley, if you can, what are some of the common issues we need to do when we're recruiting? For example, do we have to carry out background checks on new employees?
You don't have to, but it is quite common, particularly in some sectors, such as professional services and financial services. And certainly it's a requirement for some regulated roles. The checks that would be carried out are things like references, credit checks, criminal record checks. However, it's worth noting that there are certain data protection requirements around the criminal record checks, which employers need to comply with. In addition, employers have to carry out specific right to work checks to make sure that anyone they're employing has their right to work in the UK. And these checks need to be done for all new recruits, regardless of nationality. And that's to avoid the risk of discrimination. Now, this is really important because employing someone illegally is a criminal offence, and it's got a fine of up to £45,000 per employee. There is a defence to this, and that is to carry out the correct right to work checks and document those properly before the employee starts work.
That is some severe penalties. They're not that high here in the US, but certainly there are some restrictions in each case. And we use a practice of references here a lot, and a lot of other countries, I'm sure, want to get a sense of what the employee's background was in terms of how they work and who they work for and any other types of personal references they have. Do we need to have a reference in the UK? Do employers look for those?
Yeah, employers will look for them. But in terms of whether old employers have to give them, well, that's a slightly different question. So in the financial services sector, the employers in that space do have to provide a full reference for an employee who was in a regulated role if they are going to another regulated role at another firm. So they have an obligation to provide a reference. Beyond that, there's no legal requirement, there's no general requirement to provide a reference in respect of one of your former employees. But in practice, most employers do that. Now, what we tend to see is that they'll just confirm the employee's job title and the dates of employment. They keep it simple. And that's largely because where an employer does provide a reference, where it chooses to provide a reference, it has a duty to make sure it's accurate, that it's balanced, that it's not misleading. And there are some cases where an employer has put negative information in a reference and the employee has been able to bring a claim against the old employer because of that. And again, perhaps a bit more technically, where an employer says too much in a reference and is maybe not balanced in the right kind of way for the new employer can have some rights of action potentially against the old employer for that reference. So it can be a bit tricky. So most employers simply stick to basic factual information just to reduce the risks of those sorts of claims.
It's interesting. Today, when I get a call for a reference, you often think about, you know, the downstream impact of your reference. Some people use the same reference over and over, even years after they left. So I think keeping things pretty neutral does make a lot of sense. Do employees and workers get a written contract in the UK?
Yes, so most of them do. But from a legal requirement, there isn't a need to give a formal written employment contract. But an employer does have to give them certain written particulars of employment on day one. And those written particulars include things like details of their job responsibilities, their notice period, details of their pay, their hours, and their holiday. Now, as I say, they don't need to be set out in a formal contract, but in practice, most of the time they are. And that contract will usually include other protections for the employer, such as confidentiality. And certainly for more senior employees, you're likely to see things like post-termination restrictions, such as non-competes and non-poaching provisions.
One of the other issues that comes up often is the ability for the employee to compete when they leave. And many of our jurisdictions have restrictions around non-compete. So if you include a non-compete restriction in the UK, do you have to pay the employee during that period?
No. No, the starting point is that it can be an unpaid period. It doesn't have to be paid to be enforceable. Enforceability instead is judged much more about the scope of the restriction. So the restrictions themselves have to be no wider than is necessary to protect that employer's interests. Otherwise, it is void. It's struck out in its entirety. And in terms of the width, that's both, or the reasonableness, that's both in terms of the scope of the restriction, such as the geographical area that it's covering and the areas of the business which are being covered, but also the period of the restriction too, how long it will last. So the longest that's been permitted in case law here is a restriction of 12 months. But in many cases, only 3 months or 6 months would be justifiable. It all depends on the individual, the role, their seniority, and those sorts of considerations. Now, importantly, the UK government is proposing to limit all non-compete restrictions, all non-compete covenants, to 3 months in due course. That's the plan, although we don't have any specific date as to when that change will come into effect. So a lot of our clients now are already starting to review their other covenants, the sort of covenants that Ailey mentioned around non-solicit, non-poach, things like that, and other restrictions in other documents like incentive plans, just to make sure if that change to 3 months limitation did come into effect, they do have adequate protection in other places too.
Another important topic is pay, benefits, some of those topics that are, you know, universal for employment law. What are the pay and benefits requirements for UK employers when they hire someone? Ailey?
So all UK workers are entitled to minimum wage, and this varies by age. But the current rate for employees aged 23 and over is £10.42 per hour. This will increase in April, as it does every year, to £11.44 per hour. And at that point, it's actually going to also be extended to workers aged 21 or over. There are actually separate lower rates for younger workers, but these are the kind of the standard ones. So in addition to the national minimum wage, employers also have to enrol all workers who earn at least £10,000 a year into a pension scheme that meets certain legal requirements. The minimum contribution for an employer is 3% of salary, and the worker then must pay in 5% of their salary. So workers can choose to opt out of the pension scheme if they want, but the employer can't actively encourage or incentivize them to opt out. So this is referred to as auto-enrolment, and it was brought in 2012 with a view to ensuring that all workers have the opportunity to save into a pension. And it's actually been quite successful, with now over kind of 85% of workers being enrolled in a pension. So aside from the pension and statutory holiday requirements, there aren't any specific obligations to provide benefits. But in practice, a lot of employers, particularly for more senior employees or in kind of professional industries, will be providing things like insured benefits, so life assurance or private medical.
Well, holidays is an interesting topic. And I remember every summer when I was younger and traveled in Europe or the UK, most people were on a holiday. So let's define a holiday if we can. And I wish we had that here in the States, but it's pretty impressive to see how the work-life balance really comes together in other parts of the world. What are the holiday workers entitled to in the UK from the standpoint?
Yeah, so the minimum statutory holiday under the working time regulations, which is the legislation that provides for holiday entitlement, is 5.6 weeks per year. So if you've got someone who's working a 5-day working week, that translates to 28 days holiday for the year. Now, in practice, and maybe in your experience too, Pete, many employers in the UK offer more holiday, particularly for senior employees. So you might find something like 5 weeks per year plus public holidays. And there are 8 public holidays in England and Wales. There are more in Scotland and Northern Ireland, but 8 public holidays in England and Wales. So this gives you 33 days a year for someone who's working a 5-day week.
So, and if you're visiting England and Wales in August, you probably won't have any trouble getting downtown and finding a parking place, I'm going to guess. Yes, that sounds about right. Well, let's get into the rules around hours, work, overtime. Ailey, what do you think that is all about?
So, so we have rules around hours of work, which is derived from our old EU law that still exists post-Brexit. So there is a 48-hour limit on the average weekly working time. And so all employers have to provide certain minimum rest breaks as well, daily and weekly rest breaks too. There are exceptions to this 48-hour weekly limit, including for managing executives who felt to be able to organise their own working time. So this is often used, for example, for company directors and other senior managers. It is also possible for employees to opt out of their 48-hour limit. And some employers will require all their employees to do this. It often happens just at the start of employment, although the employees must be allowed to opt back in if they want to. And so you see the opt-out letters that say you can opt back into this anytime, although very rarely employees do that. In relation to overtime, there are no specific rules governing overtime. This is very much a matter for agreement between the employer and the employee, and it'll often be covered by the terms of the employment contract, or it might be part of a collective agreement with a trade union.
So let's move this on from kind of a traditional work environment to what has impacted us around the globe is this notion of working from home or hybrid working, flexible hours. How are UK employers approaching the whole flexible and hybrid working scenario now that we're a couple years on from the pandemic? And what kind of changes are you seeing, Tim?
Yeah, we are seeing changes here. It is interesting. So many UK employers introduce some form of permanent hybrid working arrangements after the pandemic. But in recent times, we are seeing more employers wanting increased office presence. Now, whether that's setting out a minimum requirement or increasing the requirement to come into the office, say it was 3 days, now we're looking for 4 days. So we're seeing a bit more of that in recent times. Now, in many cases, the employer can simply mandate this, but they do need to consider potential discrimination angles. So where you have employees with caring responsibilities or who themselves have disabilities. And this does link in with a change that we're going to see to flexible working laws in the UK. At the moment, employees who have at least 6 months' service can make a statutory request to work flexibly. Now, from this April, this right will apply to all employees from day one of their employment. So employers may start seeing an increase in these sorts of requests and will have to deal with competing requests for flexible working from different employees. Now, worth flagging, this is only a right to request. It's not an automatic right to work flexibly, but employers do need to make sure they have objective and justifiable grounds to refuse a request if that's what they decide to do. And we've been working a lot with clients on updating their policies and training managers so they're equipped and ready to deal with these requests when they come in.
Very interesting. Early on, you defined the three different types of workers that you had. And the one thing that seemed consistent there was that discrimination covered those other classes as well as the employee. So let's talk about from employee to worker to self-employed contractors. What are those protections under the discrimination laws?
Yeah, so as you say, it covers employees, workers, and self-employed contractors. And it's also worth adding that it protects agency workers and also partners in a firm. Job applicants are also covered by our discrimination laws. So the discrimination laws cover discrimination and also harassment, and that's on the grounds of sex, race, disability, age, sexual orientation, religion and belief, and also pregnancy and maternity, and then also gender reassignment and marital status. The compensation for successful discrimination and harassment claims is unlimited, and it's based on an individual's financial losses. So the amount generally depends on how much they will earn and how long they're going to be out of work. So sometimes you see very big numbers if an individual, for example, gets large bonuses or they have a very generous pension pot. But it is worth noting that those very large numbers are quite rare because it is only usually in those circumstances. But an individual can also claim for an amount for injury to feelings, and the compensation for them can be for that claim can be anywhere between around £1,000 up to £56,000. But typically awards for this will be in the region of £10,000 to £20,000. So as you can tell, discrimination claims can be very expensive, but just as importantly, they can be reputationally damaging. And so even if the employer ultimately wins, there's often a lot of mud thrown, and some of it obviously sticks. And this is why employers will often try to seek to settle discrimination claims before they go to tribunal if they can. It's also worth noting that there are some changes coming up in this area. And this October, there's going to be a new positive duty on employers to take steps to prevent sexual harassment in the workplace. And if they don't, then they can face an uplift in the sexual harassment compensation of up to 25%. That is if the employee brings a successful claim. In addition, in the financial services sector, there are going to be new requirements for financial services firms relating to diversity coming in 2025, which will include diversity targets and reporting requirements for larger firms. So we're doing a lot of work with clients, not just in the financial services sector, but across all sectors, particularly reviewing and updating their diversity and harassment policies and procedures. and also delivering training for their managers and staff, which is really important as part of preventing harassment at work.
We've covered a lot of really critical topics that are impacting businesses all around the world, and understanding where the UK stands on that is great. I want to talk about pay equity, Tim. What about equal pay? Is this covered as well by discrimination law?
Yes, yeah, it is covered by our discrimination laws, although it works a little differently. It is quite a complicated area over here. But in essence, a woman is entitled to receive equal pay to a man who is doing the same job or a job that's of equal value to her job. So there's an assessment around sort of valuation of roles. So there are some ongoing cases at the moment involving large supermarkets here in the UK where female employees who are, for example, stacking shelves in the shops are claiming they should be paid the same as male employees who are working in the supermarket's warehouse. So different roles, but arguably roles of equal value is their claim. Now, I know that the forthcoming EU Pay Transparency Directive is going to require employers with at least 100 employees to publish gender pay gap information. So in the UK, we've had our own gender pay gap reporting requirements for about 6 years now, and these apply to employers with at least 250 employees, and they have to publish gender pay gap information annually. So when the EU directive comes in, if a UK business has operations in the EU, it may well want to look at how the EU reporting requirements are going to compare with the UK requirements and whether perhaps they should be creating consistent reports across different jurisdictions.
So let's move on if we can. We've covered the employee life cycle here in many ways, from hiring to the rights they have as employees. Let's move on now and look at dismissal. Haley, what are the reasons that you can use to justify dismissing an employee in the UK?
So the answer partly depends on how long the employee has been employed. If the employee has at least 2 years' service, they can bring an unfair dismissal claim. And to defend this, the employer needs to show that they had a fair reason for dismissal, and that would be something like misconduct or poor performance or redundancy, and that they also followed a fair procedure. So compensation for unfair dismissal is based on financial loss, as with discrimination, but it is capped, and that cap is at the lower of 1 year's salary or around about £105,000. There is also an additional basic award based on age and length of service, which is capped at around £19,000. So the overall compensation for unfair dismissal is obviously much lower than it could be under discrimination. We often also get asked, if an employee doesn't have 2 years service, can you just dismiss them without any good reason or process? And so in theory, you can, but an employer will run the risk that they will claim dismissal was for something else, like discrimination or whistleblowing, for which you don't need that 2 years service, and obviously for which there is no cap on the compensation. So if someone has less than 2 years service, even though an employer doesn't necessarily need to follow the full process, we would usually recommend that they have some sort of justification or at least a paper trail that backs up the real reason why they are terminating, just so to avoid the kind of the risk of the discrimination claim coming up.
So following up on that point, Tim, well, what happens if a business doesn't want to go through a process and instead decides to create a termination that's mutually acceptable to the employee and settling those claims? Can that work?
Yes, yeah, no, absolutely it does. And it's certainly not unusual to have some sort of severance agreement in place, especially for some more senior employees. So you can certainly enter into a settlement agreement that will end the employment and it will resolve all legal claims. Now, to be properly valid, it has to meet certain requirements. And one of these includes the employee getting independent legal advice on the document, which the employer would tend to pay a contribution towards, although that's not a legal requirement. You do need to be careful in the discussions you have when you're trying to broker this sort of deal, because there's always a risk the employee won't take it and will instead decide to bring some sort of claim against the organization. And the settlement discussions you're having may well then be admissible in the legal proceedings if they aren't truly off the record or without prejudice. So you need to be careful to show that you would be committed to the process you would otherwise have put in place, either a redundancy or a disciplinary process or whatever it would be, and have a mind as to where that process would end up if the employee doesn't take the deal. Again, we often help clients to prepare for this sort of meeting with a script and prompts that the manager can use.
Ailey, you had mentioned earlier about whistleblowing being one of the claims that an employee can make. What should employers know about or be aware of with regard to whistleblowing in the UK?
Yeah, so you'll be aware that the EU has introduced the whistleblowing directive in the past couple of years. And in the UK, we've had whistleblowing laws in place for over 25 years. But there are some differences between our whistleblowing laws and the EU directive. And that's mainly that we don't have the same requirement for employers to have a whistleblowing policy in place. And that is except for the financial services sector. In practice, though, most employers do have some sort of whistleblowing policy and internal and external channels for speaking up. So in the UK, it's automatically unfair to dismiss an employee for whistleblowing, and they can claim unlimited compensation for their losses. Similar to discrimination claims, they don't have to have the 2-year minimum service requirement. So basically, anyone can bring a whistleblowing claim, regardless of how long they've been employed. Now, this, I think I mentioned earlier, is an area where we're seeing a lot of activity, and we're frequently advising clients on handling whistleblowing investigations, as well as putting in place processes and policies for them. And we've also been doing quite a lot of work with our multinational clients on implementing global whistleblowing policies and channels, which involves carefully thinking, obviously, about the data protection implications in terms of transferring data across borders and to and from third-party whistleblowing hotline providers. And that's obviously increased even more so with the EU whistleblowing directive.
Tim, let's shift gears to the collective employee consulting, or the collective bargaining, if you will. What obligations do employers have in the UK for working, for example, with a works council? Can you fill us in on that?
Yeah, sure. So some larger employers will have a UK works council. So that'll be something that's either set up through the statutory National Works Council process, or maybe set up by agreement between the employer and employees. So it might be something like an employee forum that exists. We do also have a European Works Council, or some larger employers will have European Works Councils, or EWCs, which were set up before Brexit. Since Brexit, UK employees can't make a request to set up a new EWC, but they can continue to participate in existing EWCs. So those are the types of organisations we see. There can also be ongoing consultation requirements under a collective agreement with a trade union if the employer itself recognises a trade union. Trade union recognition is more common in certain sectors than others. So, for example, you will probably see it more in the public sector, as well as in transport and manufacturing.
So what are the scenarios, or what do we do when there is no works council or no trade union? What are the options there?
So there's only a couple of scenarios in which all employers have kind of duties to collectively consult in the UK, regardless of the presence of a works council or a trade union. And one of those circumstances is where the employer is making multiple redundancies. And so that is at least 20 in a 90-day period, or where they're changing terms and conditions of at least 20 employees using fire and rehire. And fire and rehire, just to be aware, is the process where an employer will dismiss and then immediately offer re-employment on new terms. So that's the first circumstances where collective consultation might be required. And then the other is where there is a business transfer, such as a sale of a business or a change in service provider, for example, an outsourcing or moving to a new supplier. Now, in both of those situations, the employer has to consult elected representatives, and that is unless there was a trade union, in which case they would consult the trade union. So in those circumstances, there would be an election, basically, of the through the employees that are affected, and then those individuals would be consulted with. So the penalties for breaching these consultation requirements can be quite significant. So in terms of the redundancies, it's up to 90 days pay per employee. And for a failure to consult on a business transfer, it can be 13 weeks pay per employee. So it's quite important to get this one right.
So let's talk about a topic that came up on Employment Matters over 3 years ago. I remember this broadcast very clearly when the world is scratching their heads saying, the UK is going to leave the European Union. What's that going to be like? How are we going to have it? Who's going to tell us what's happening? Well, fast forward now, it's 3 years later, and Brexit has taken effect. What has been the impact on the employment laws in the UK based on Brexit, Tim?
Yeah, I think, generally speaking, it's fair to say it's had very little impact on employment laws in the UK, and the government isn't planning to make any major changes to employment law following Brexit. Now, there will be a few minor changes relating to holiday pay and, touching on what Ailey said, consultation on business transfers, which will be of some practical help for employers, but there haven't been, and we aren't expecting there to be any major changes to employees' rights. I think one area where we have seen a lot of activity, though, in a related area, is on business immigration. We're finding an increasing number of clients are moving to get immigration sponsor licenses so they can fill skilled or specialist roles here. And obviously, that's something which flows directly out of the immigration changes coming from Brexit.
Ailey, Tim mentioned earlier in the broadcast that there's an election coming up later this year. And what would this new government mean for UK employment laws? How's it going to impact us?
Yeah, so if the next election, which is expected to be in autumn this year, results in a win for the Labour Party, who are the party currently in opposition, then there could be some significant changes to employment law. So just to explain, the Labour Party is our more left of centre party, which is compared to the current government, the Conservatives, who are the more right-leaning party. And there is therefore an expectation that if the Labour Party gets in, they will look to improve employee rights. So they've indicated that they will ban 0 hours contracts, and they will also ban fire and rehire, that concept I mentioned earlier. And they will also make it easier to claim unfair dismissal. They've also said that they would remove some of the requirements around organising industrial action, making it easier for employees to strike. And they would also look to introduce sector-wide collective bargaining, which is obviously common in Europe, but it would be a new concept for the UK. So there could be quite a lot of changes on the horizon, depending on the election result. But we'll just have to wait and see on that one.
I think we will. And boy, was that a thorough walk around England and Wales countryside with two of our friends from London. Really interesting. Thanks a lot for your time. Ailey, Tim?
Thanks ever so much.
Great. Thanks, Pete.
If you'd like to connect with Tim or Ailey, you can find their bios by clicking on their names in the description of this podcast. Also visit ela.law to receive information and invitations to our upcoming webinars, download white papers, get access to on-demand content from our online library, or use the ELA's exclusive Global Employer Handbook. You've been listening to Employment Matters, a podcast brought to you by the Employment Law Alliance, the world's largest network of labor and employment lawyers from the best law firms around the globe. I'm Pete Waltz. Thanks so much for listening.